I'm John Krall. Today on No Limits, we're going to talk with Michael Huber, the president and CEO of the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce. We'll talk about the challenges and opportunities before businesses in central Indiana, and we'll talk about the chamber's role in the fight over a proposed constitutional amendment banning same-sex marriage in Indiana. We also will talk about the chamber's many other priorities. We invite you to join the conversation. Please call us at 866-476-3881. Our email is nolimits@wfyi.org. Facebook is No Limits WFYI, and Twitter is WFYI. Now, this news.
No Limits is made possible by Apparatus, managing IT infrastructure so companies don't have to. It's advanced IT made simple. Learn more at apparatus.net.
Welcome to No Limits. I am John Krall, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the statehousefile.com, and your host. We are talking today with the president and CEO of the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce, Michael Huber. Michael, welcome to the program.
John, thanks for having me.
It's good to have you here. If our listeners would like to join the conversation, they can do so by giving us a call at 866-476-3881. You can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or tumble upon us at Twitter at WFYI. Well, we probably ought to start. The Chamber of Commerce is one of those institutions that, because it has become such an institution and such a figure of speech, is something everyone knows about without probably realizing exactly what it is. So I think I'd like to start this conversation by talking a little bit about what the structure of the Chamber of Commerce is, what the mission is, and then we're going to drill down to some of the other areas that you're involved in.
So, yeah, the chamber, I've only been in this job since September of last year, so I've had to do my own kind of history lesson on the chamber. It was created in 1890 by Eli Lilly and a number of other Indianapolis business leaders. And as I've done my, read my history to try to understand more about the institution, you almost couldn't have written a better mission statement in 1890 for the institution. And I'm paraphrasing here, but in the words of Colonel Lilly, he said, "We need to bring business together so that they can support each other, support the public on, making the best decisions in the public sector, using the term was like using data and figures and analysis to elevate the public debate above, the bickering that can take place." I'm paraphrasing, but it's really, really interesting. And that was really the genesis of the organization in 1890. Later on, it becomes the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce. And we've got about 2,400 businesses across all different sectors, although 2,000 of those businesses would really be considered small businesses of about 50 employees or less. We have a very large board, and it's made up of the CEOs and presidents of small and medium and large businesses. We basically do three things. Number one, we are an association of businesses, and so we have various programs and services in place to help those businesses meet each other, develop new collaborations, develop new relationships across different industries, and that's something that we will always do. The second thing we do is we lobby and we advocate, mm-hmm. as the organization has done since its inception. The nature of the lobbying is changing. That we do. I would say a generation ago, chambers of commerce would very commonly get involved in those issues that directly impacted their members and their businesses. We still do that. The nature of our lobbying is expanding, though, to basically to try to do the right thing to enhance the economic climate. So, yes, directly to benefit our members, but also to create the kind of economic climate where anybody has opportunity here in Indianapolis. And then the third thing we do, and this is a recent development in the last 3 years, there are three local economic development agencies. Mm. One does the marketing and branding of Indianapolis region worldwide. One does the kind of brick and mortar type economic development with expanding companies, and one is Small Business and Entrepreneur Services. Those three organizations have been merged under the chamber prior to me starting in September, and so we've become really the de facto economic development organization for the region, and so that's very exciting. So between those among those three different areas, but they do have some overlap. It keeps you really busy at the chamber.
Well, I'm interested by the fact that you say that the sort of the lobbying piece of that has changed over time, and to some degrees, in some ways, has expanded. Could you give us some concrete examples, some issues, say, that the chamber would have been focused on a generation ago? Or probably a better example, since you say it's expanded, something you wouldn't have been involved in a generation ago that you are now.
So certainly issues of taxation and regulation and those things that directly impact our members, we would have been involved in as an organization a generation ago, and we still are today. The best examples I could think of now would be the chamber's strong support for, say, mass transit.
Mm-hmm.
And that's an issue that predates me. And we've got an exciting opportunity now, as you and your mm-hmm. listeners probably know, to go to a referendum, likely in 2015 or 2016, for folks to pay a little more income tax to have a significant upgrade in bus service and in bus rapid transit. That was the issue that I'd say a generation ago it would have been less likely for the chamber to get mm-hmm. to get involved there. For us, it was a labor mobility problem first and foremost. As Indianapolis mm-hmm. becomes more developed and as we become more spread out as a region, we just do a poor job getting our folks to work compared to some of our competitor cities. Another issue that we got involved in the fall of last year, as your listeners know, was HDR 6 and HDR 3, the effort to write the single definition of marriage into the Indiana Constitution. That was an issue that our members, if you take their our members' actual views on same-sex marriage, it's probably all over the map. Mm-hmm. On this particular issue, though, of do we want to write this into the Constitution, we had very broad consensus
that we can't ever revisit the question.
It makes it very difficult. So that was an issue we got involved in. I'll say thirdly. The expanding early childhood education is something that we've been very involved in. We're working on an economic impact study of expanding early childhood education with other partners, including United Way and including other philanthropic organizations. And we're seeing the overwhelming evidence that the more kids you move into quality early childhood education, it doesn't guarantee success for these children, but it puts them on an entirely different trajectory for their educational career. And that's an important business issue as we try to mm-hmm. figure out how can the business community do something about the poverty rate and do something about our equally or alarming lack of upward mobility in the Indianapolis area. So the issues that we take on are expanding, and mm-hmm. we're trying to, and I do a lot of time talking with our members, hearing mm-hmm. from them, but then also trying to talk about this issue of economic mobility goes hand in hand with success of business, and that's something that I feel very strongly about, and that's something that our members and corporate leadership really get.
We are talking with Michael Huber, who is the president and CEO of the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce. If you'd like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. One of the things, what you're saying here strikes me as if it doesn't undercut it, to some degree challenges what is the popular perception, maybe misperception, of what the chamber is, which is that its lobbying focuses almost exclusively on, okay, how do we keep taxes low?
Yeah.
How do we keep that down? How do we drive that down? We're all about opposing taxation or anything like that. But in at least one case for your priorities, mass transit, you're talking about what would be a modest tax increase,
yes,
but one that would be there, and probably early childhood education. You're also going to have to find some funding for that. Does that represent a change sort of in the way the chamber approaches things, or has that always been a misperception about the chamber?
I think on one hand it's always been a misperception about this chamber of commerce, because they have at various times, if you look throughout history, stood up and said, yes, we believe the responsible thing to do is to institute this tax or raise this tax. When they felt that there was a clear public benefit. But I think now I think both are true. I think we're also in completely different territory. The reason I say that is if you look at the economic development of U.S. cities today, the game has changed so much in the last 10 years, and it's changed even in the last five. Mm-hmm. And I've spoken to, you know, the past three mayors about mm-hmm. this issue and past couple of governors about this issue. So the U.S. cities are actually still highly differentiated places in terms of their local economies. And in the last 5 to 10 years, there's been a separation from the pack of these six cities that you'd consider to be really prosperous. Mm-hmm. And the biggest differentiating factor is a city's ability to attract talent and retain the talent that it has. Mm-hmm. So take New York and San Francisco, or the Bay Area, where my wife and my mother are both from. I consider those to be outliers. Mm-hmm. Even if you look at Austin, Texas, and Portland, Oregon, those cities are really hot cities for young, talented mm-hmm. folks, and I'd say talented folks of all ages. So, their local economies are really thriving because of it. Now, I do think some of it is Indianapolis needs to tell our story better, because in some mm-hmm. ways we have more assets than Austin and more than Portland and more opportunity in some ways for young folks. But I do think this notion of the war for talent mm-hmm. is making every city, and I'm going to say every state, sort of rethink its strategy. It's becoming, and I worked in the past for Mayor Greg Ballard. I worked in a deputy level position for Governor Mitch Daniels. And so I applaud, you know, a lot of the things that those two in particular have done. That being said, I think it is playing out before our eyes, though, that we can't just be the low-cost provider. In fact, mm-hmm. I'll say if Indiana's only identity and Indianapolis's only identity is as the lowest-cost provider, there are southern states and southern cities that are going to eat our lunch.
Yeah, you're not going to be able to underpin those
now,
folks.
I do think, though, we've got significant assets to work with here that a lot of cities don't have in manufacturing, mm-hmm. in pharmaceuticals, and the life sciences that they don't have. And so we're as we try to, both on the lobbying side and economic development side, craft a better economic development strategy that really reflects the reality of today, I think Indiana can be a high-value player mm-hmm. because affordability still matters. I detest bureaucracy, and our members detest, you know, bureaucracy, but there are sometimes when it's necessary to make these public investments in assets like mass transit in your parks and your connectivity. Look at a project like the Cultural Trail mm-hmm. and how that's really changed the way people think about connected places. Mm-hmm. And these are all really important factors if we start to think about, okay, how can we retain the talented grads of Purdue, Butler, IU, Notre Dame, Franklin College, of all of our great universities, and also create the kind of city where there's a buzz, and yeah. we're starting to attract more of the talent from other places as well.
Well, I'd like to. We're going to talk about some of the other priorities, and we're going to have a detailed conversation, I think, about the whole same-sex marriage thing, because there's a news hook, early childhood head, education as well. But I'd like to talk a little bit about how you set the priorities, how the chamber does that. You mentioned you've got a large board. How many people are on that board?
Over 100.
Over 100.
Yeah.
Now, on all of these things, do you get them all together for a vote,
no.
or so? Yeah. How do you go about saying, okay, we think you know mass transit should be a priority here?
So. Over 100 board members. We have an executective committee of about 23, I think is the number.
So the size of a normal board in other places.
And then it's been like that for a long time. It's a big, we're a big tent, you know.
Yeah.
But then I don't make policy for the chamber, and staff doesn't make policy for the chamber. We have councils, and the idea of the councils, so we have Education Workforce Council, we have Transportation Infrastructure and Environment Council, and others. They are made up of people from different industries. And the idea is that the councils, depending on what's happening in the world, they'll meet every 4 to 8 weeks. And part of my job is to tee up the most current issues or issues that we can see coming down the road for mm-hmm. them. And they vet and they vote and they take policy positions that the board ultimately approves. But the really what we're trying to do is facilitate a discussion where business leaders from different industries develop, who have, say, a passion for education, develop real expertise in education. But the exciting thing is it might be a banker or it might be an engineer. So they're bringing a different perspective to taking an issue on something like early childhood education policy. So, yeah, managing the councils, these various councils, even though it does get chaotic, is one of the most interesting aspects of the job for sure, because you're constantly – and the goal is to get these very, very different perspectives that you'd get maybe from someone who's kind of an inside player or someone who's an academic. No disrespect, John.
So, none taken. So, is your charge then basically to go out and sort of propose issues that they might take a look at? That's it. And how do you go about culling, figuring that out?
Any issue that we think impacts business in a meaningful way, we tee that up for our councils. And now sometimes the public will ask us to take a stance, that happens frequently as well.
We are talking with the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce President and CEO, Michael Huber. If you would like to join the conversation, you can do so by calling us at 866-476-3881. You can send an email to nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at NoLimitsWFYI or on Twitter at WFYI. I am John Kroll. You're listening to No Limits. Please stay with us. Welcome back to No Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We are talking with Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Michael Huber. Just before we went to the break, we were talking about how the chamber goes about choosing the issues that are going to be priorities for it, and said basically, you call, look around, tee them up, and then there's a process that involves an executive committee, councils, and then ultimately the entire board. One of the other things, perceptions that's out there, is that the chamber is kind of a monolith. But last year, shortly after this time, the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce took a position on the same-sex marriage debate, at least the proposal to amend the Indiana Constitution. The state chamber did not. Could you talk about what the relationship is between the Indianapolis Chamber and the state chamber? And, because I know that created some confusion at the time as well.
Yeah. We have a great relationship with the state chamber. Kevin Brinneker and his organization do a great job representing the business interests. But the state chamber covers the entire state of Indiana. Mm-hmm. And I would venture to guess that, on any given day, we're probably in agreement on 90% of the issues or more. In fact, a lot of my board members make up the state chambers, also serve on the board of the state chamber. But, the Indianapolis chamber, we've got to have a very targeted focus on our basically 9-county region. Mm-hmm. The problems and the issues that we face if we really zero in on Indianapolis, many times will be issues that are by nature a little more urban, mm-hmm. that deal with the great opportunities, but also the challenges of a more developed city. Just in the built environment, where you've got more, you've got older buildings and brownfields and things like that. We also, Indianapolis, we have a disproportionate share of the poverty in the state that we need to find a way to deal with, and I mm-hmm. think and our members in business here are realizing that. Hence our involvement on things like early childhood education. So, it's a very supportive relationship with the state chamber. They, I believe, have many of the same processes that we do as they vet issues. It's just the difference between a statewide focus and a more metro focus that we have.
We've gotten a question from a listener who didn't want to go on the air. It says, with struggling city schools and lack of progressive citywide initiatives such as effective public transit, how can Indy expect to be competitive with other cities when trying to attract and retain young professionals and young families? You were talking a little bit about that before the break, and to some degree it plays into the discussion of the same-sex marriage, too. Could you talk a little bit?
Yeah, so the default position for me is to be the city's cheerleader, right? The chamber president, that's your job. But in a question like this, I start to think of almost as the GM for a mid-market sports team who doesn't have the resources of the Yankees, but is trying to beat the Yankees. So Indianapolis is doing a much better job now than compared to 20 years ago in terms of attracting talent from elsewhere. We have some really great employers like Lilly and Rolls-Royce and Roche Diagnostics to thank for that. But we also have, I think, we do have a competitive advantage if we use it and if we're smart here in the future. If you put Indianapolis toe-to-toe with Austin, Texas, or mm-hmm. with Portland, and I love those cities, and just based on perception of cool, we're gonna struggle. We're much better than we were 20 years ago, but right now we're gonna struggle. Some of that is we need to do a better job talking about ourselves. But if you overlay accessibility and cool, or convenience and cool, and you also can tout our quality of life, because mm-hmm. I mean our affordability, you can have a really high quality of life here in terms of you can live in an urban neighborhood, you can live in a suburban neighborhood, you can live on 5 acres, and you can still be, you know, within short driving distance of downtown and your major economic centers. You can access things like sports and culture. Maybe we don't have all the things that New York has in the numbers, because we don't have the numbers of people, but to the extent that we have these things and these institutions, they're much more accessible to the average person. And I think thirdly, we need to do a better job selling the civic culture of Indianapolis, because I didn't grow up here. I grew up in a very small town in central Illinois. And I know so many people who are engaged in civic life, mm-hmm. I'm going to say over half, who actually aren't from Indianapolis. They came in from somewhere else. They got plugged in. They got drafted into other things. There's actually what I've found to be a lack of provincial thinking here. Mm-hmm. Compared to what some people complain about, and we need to figure out a better job of touting that. I think we've got a real chance on the accessibility and cool, you know, those mm-hmm. factors working together in competing with some of our other cities. We just need to be realistic and really build on that.
And I want to talk, because obviously the same-sex marriage fight is in mm-hmm. the news right now, the argument in front of the appellate court and all of that. I'd like to talk a little bit about how the Indianapolis Chamber arrived at its position on that, because it seems to me it plays into the listener's question as well.
Yeah. Basically, it was my third week on the job in September, and all the members of
Welcome to the fire.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. And all of the members of our different councils met in a big room for mm-hmm. a day-long retreat. Mm-hmm. And it's not a direct democracy, but there's a regular mm-hmm. consensus building vetting process that we go through.
Yeah.
And they selected, at the time it was called HJR6, they selected this as one of the top priorities that the chamber needed to take a position on in the legislative session in 2015, citing basically two factors. Mm-hmm. One was primarily procedural, but mm-hmm. there was some more philosophical than that. The procedural is the like I said, if we had taken a scientific poll of everybody in the room, we would have found a variety of perspectives on existing state law. Mm-hmm. Okay. But this idea of writing it into the Constitution, our members saw as very divisive. They gave accounts of predicting money on both sides of the issues pouring in from out of state, mm-hmm. Various TV ads, basically the kind of thing that could be that just was not a productive use of time and would distract from other issues we needed to get done at the General Assembly. But I think there was more of a philosophical point than that, and that was basically saying, as a state, we're making a lot of progress in terms of putting ourselves on the map and enhancing the state as a high-quality place to live. Why would we do this? Why would we send this message that could be perceived as divisive, that you're the one group of people or another group of people are not welcome here? And that fueled the debate as well.
Was the support – I mean, one of the arguments – I know Micah Clark, who is on the other side,
yes.
and is one of the – leading advocates for social conservatives and all of that, made the argument at the time that that this was a decision that needed to be made by the public, not those nicely dressed elitists in the boardrooms at the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce, and even made the argument that it was the huge corporate culture and not the small businesses that were driving this.
Yeah.
Was there that kind of split on your board among your constituents?
No.
No,
I mean that was amazing. Mm-hmm. Because you would assume that so the vast majority of our membership being made up of small businesses, you would expect that if we made an important decision that went against the desires of small business, that there'd be that we'd have a mass exodus of members who'd be citing this issue.
Yeah, they'd vote with their feet.
Yeah, and the fact is the chamber has been losing membership for several years now, in sort of a slow steady loss. Now, a lot of that is because of the changes in healthcare, federal healthcare, based on a healthcare product that we have offered along with other chambers called Chamber Care, which is which offers a 5% premium discount that, at least for a couple of years, it looked like was going away. Now we know that it's changing. We did not see a mass exodus of members. We didn't, you know, see a large drop off based on this issue. I know we lost a few. I also know we gained a few. I have a number of emails that I've still saved based on businesses saying, thank you for having the courage to take this stance. You know, we know it's not, you know, unanimous, but thank you for having the courage to take this on and lead. Mm-hmm. So, but you know, our process is fair for criticism when we've got 2,400 members. And so I can take the criticism. What I can say, though, is the consensus was quite overwhelming, at least based on the procedural aspect, that this, as a constitutional amendment, was not a good use of time. And what's happening today is really a validation of what a lot of people felt, that this is something that's headed for the courts. It's a matter of time, not a good use of time. Focus on education, focus on economic development, focus on infrastructure.
Will you take a position again if it comes back? In the last session, obviously, they stripped out the civil union language, basically.
Yeah.
Which a lot of businesses, that was the part that, the Cummins is focused on, saying that it was going to make it very difficult for them to attract talent. Now that that part is gone, will that change the chamber's position, or will you still be in opposition to the amendment?
It's hard to say. It's hard to predict. I know that I would tee it up again. Mm-hmm. As is the process, right? I would present it to the councils for vetting and review, whatever happens. I get the sense, though, that some of our employers, and yes, they did represent these employers that I'm about to talk about, did represent larger and mid-sized businesses, did feel like their ability to tailor their benefit programs to their employees how they saw fit to attract the talent was really an issue of their right as a business owner. And one thing they didn't like about the constitutional amendment was they really saw this as an effort to limit them and limit the types of programs that they offered to attract employees, especially those from elsewhere. So I don't think it's going away. I can say with certainty I would at least tee it up again for our councils to review.
For reconsideration.
Correct.
We are talking with the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Michael Huber. If you would like to join the conversation, you can find us on Facebook at No Limits WFYI, on Twitter at WFYI. You can give us a call at 866-476-3881, or you can do as Jerry did, send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Jerry's question is, would the Chamber of Commerce representative explain why it is perfectly fair that sales tax is assessed on the purchase of toilet paper, which impacts even the poorest among us, but sales tax is not assessed on the purchase of equities, which only impacts those wealthy enough to purchase equities? What is the Chamber of Commerce position on this issue?
We don't have one on this issue, to my knowledge, and it's, to your listener, I apologize. It's likely something that we would need to look into. Any issue that became a major issue of state or local legislation, we would tee up for our councils and committees. And so, let me do my homework when I go back to the office and
Certainly.
See if historically we've ever taken a stance on that. I apologize to your listener.
Certainly. Well, let's take it. I'll take the spirit of the question then on this. In terms of approaching questions of taxation, is there a guiding philosophy or a set of bylaws or something, a charter that guides the chamber in making its decisions? I mean, are there certain taxes you're in favor of as opposed to certain ones that you almost always will oppose?
So the chamber has done various regional economic impact studies. The most recent ones were in 2006 and 2007. They did some in 2002. They issued something in the early 1990s called the Gift Report. These are things, it's kind of incredible because these are documents that we still refer to all the time. So to the extent that we as an organization have looked at what are the revenues necessary to sustain a healthy region, not just Indianapolis, but suburbs as well. We're constantly looking at the mix of revenues. And this brings up a recent issue, which is one of some controversy around. I get asked all the time about the commuter tax.
Mm-hmm.
And when I'm asked about the commuter tax, sometimes I try to slightly change the subject to talk more about regional mm-hmm. revenues. We're living.
Probably ought to explain to people what commuter tax is before we launch into a discussion.
So we're living in a time where to pay for government services, the basic things that we interact with, the citizens, police, infrastructure, we have property taxes paid where you live,
mm-hmm.
income taxes also paid where you live, sales tax. With very few exceptions, is really the purview of the state. So the sales tax pays for, you know, various state government functions. The fact that we pay income tax where you live and not where the income is earned
mm-hmm.
creates a very precarious situation and a big challenge, and we've been heading down this road for many, many years.
Mm-hmm.
Indianapolis as a city and many other cities, not just Indianapolis, but we have the metro area just under 2 million people. Over 200,000 drive in from some other county to work in Indianapolis
so
every
about
day.
10%.
That's right. And now there's a net migration from about 50,000 people live within Indianapolis and drive out and work in another county. But this basically means that Indianapolis's population swells about 150,000 people every day. Now, if you think about it, you pay your property taxes where you live. If you're one of those 150,000 commuters, you pay your income taxes where you live as well.
Mm-hmm.
So Indianapolis and other cities don't have any mechanism to pay for the increased public safety resources and transportation and infrastructure resources necessary to support that population. So as we get into a time where, and it's statewide, Indianapolis, Fort Wayne, Evansville, South Bend are in very similar situations, as we try to figure out how do we make our cities really vital? Because our cities also is where the population growth and the economic growth is going to happen.
And a lot of the job creation.
And a lot of the job creation is going to happen. But yet the core cities have really a built-in disadvantage in terms of tax revenues and how they're structured. We are talking more in the media, and we're talking to our counterparts in other cities about how could we create a regional revenue system that really reflects the way that we work? Right now, the way we do property and income taxes is reflective of a time where you lived in your town and you worked in your town. You lived in a county and you worked in your county. If you actually look at the commuting patterns of Indianapolis, it looks like spaghetti, right?
Mm-hmm.
If you try to map that out. So your original question was, how do you prioritize? How do you base those issues? Well, basically, we do a refresh of regional economic studies every few years. The state of Indiana, which I appreciate, issued at the end of the General Assembly a regional economies study.
Mm-hmm.
So the way that the state is thinking about this is changing as well. I'm from a small town.
Mm-hmm.
Virtually everybody that I graduated high school with who went to some form of four-year college, almost all live in major or mid-sized metros. It's unfortunate. That's just where the jobs have gone. The town that I grew up in 30 years ago is a lot different today than it was then. So what I appreciate about what the state is doing is they're almost recognizing that in the future, Indiana more and more and more, its economy is going to look like, you know, 6 to 10 nodes,
mm-hmm.
and that represent cities.
Mm-hmm.
The ones I mentioned, you know, Columbus, Indiana,
sort of
Warsaw.
Spheres of influence.
Exactly. And so the way, and it impacts our state. The way we think about ourselves as a state is changing as a result. But what I appreciate about what the state is doing is their studies are including. How do you stabilize the core city? How do you make sure that the core city is strong? The public safety infrastructure, the parks, all those amenities that are necessary. I talked earlier about the talent mm-hmm. attraction being really the differentiator. You've got to have these strong cities that are dynamic, where people see that there's opportunity. And to do so, you need substantial investment in the basics.
So does that mean that, at one time, and I'm old enough that I can remember a time that sort of the chamber's argument was to simplify the tax structure. In some ways, you're making an argument now that it needs to be much more sophisticated because the economy has gotten more sophisticated.
I think that's right. Simplification of the tax code would be it would be great if you could achieve both. In fact, that's why the commuter tax is controversial. The commuter tax would essentially be a new tax on commuters, people driving in, people who live in one mm-hmm. county and drive into another. The perfect world would be a reallocation of existing tax revenues.
Yeah.
That would be really, really difficult, especially if you're a community that benefits from a much higher proportion of residents compared to jobs. And so, a reallocation and would be great. A simplification, if you could accomplish that, would be even better. But we are trying to reflect the more complex world we live in.
We are talking with Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Michael Huber. If you would like to join the conversation, please give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. You are listening to No Limits. I am John Kroll. Please stay with us. Limits. I am John Kroll, director of Franklin College's Pulliam School of Journalism, publisher of the StatehouseFile.com, and your host. We're talking with Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce President and CEO Michael Huber. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can send us an email at nolimits@wfyi.org. Find us on Facebook at nolimitswfyi or on Twitter at wfyi. Gotten a couple of questions from callers who didn't want to go on the air. The first one is, with Indiana being an at-will state, does that have any impact on employers bringing their businesses here? Probably ought to explain to people also what at-will means, too. Those of us in the labor battles know what it means.
But. Yeah, I don't know if I can define it from a legal standpoint, but it essentially means that the average workers in non-at-will states have more protections than they typically would here in Indiana, us being an at-will state, correct?
Yeah.
Is that right?
Yep. Yeah.
It's hard to say. I know that we are regarded as being business friendly, and that's good for our members. And I know that companies we've gotten a lot of great feedback just within the past year of me being here from companies that come in and say, when I come to Indiana, I'm dealing with people who are trying to get to yes in terms of how do we do a deal and how do we do this expansion and things like that. The Indy Chamber, prior to me coming on board, so you talked about the difference between Indy Chamber and State Chamber. The Indy Chamber, prior to me coming on board, did not take a position on right to work, which was a different form of legislation. The State Chamber did in favor of right to work, and that was very controversial, as one can understand.
Continues to be. There's back and forth about a court.
So I've heard anecdotal evidence that right to work, that there are companies who have made them look at Indiana, particularly in terms of manufacturing. I haven't seen the research yet. I don't know if there's been enough time elapsed that we can really point to the gains of right to work. Now, maybe my friends at State Chamber will help me. But I think the best way to answer the caller's question is, I don't know. It's good that we have a business-friendly reputation, but I think that what you're going to see in the coming years is this idea of quality of life and the quality of the kind of quality of life that we have here in the city is becoming much more important. So, for instance, I hear less and less from companies saying, "I'm interested in Indiana. Can you tell me about your tax structure? Can you tell me about my rights as an employer? Can you tell me this?" What I do hear all the time is, what are the schools like? What are the neighborhoods like? How open is it and welcoming to international folks? I'm trying to recruit a lot of folks internationally, and that again reflects the changing nature of economic development. And it's going to be impossible to separate those kind of quality of life aspects from what's been, I do believe, in the past, much more of what's the direct cost of business? What's the kind of a brick and mortar type conversation?
And this gets to, I think, relates to another area we can talk about that's connected here, and that whole right to work debate that you mentioned. The State Chamber's position was that the doing this would help create jobs, and there's some evidence that may in fact have been the case. Folks on the other side said, it's also likely to depress wages. And there's been some evidence there, too. As is often the case in debates that get that heated, both sides have some portion of the truth on their side. And I guess where I would go, because, you know, the numbers show that Indiana, in terms of household per capita income, trails three of the four states surrounding it. And the fourth, mm-hmm. Kentucky, has been closing the gap over the past 20 years. Mm-hmm. What do we do about that, since that's a quality yep. of life issue, too? I mean, how do we elevate then yep. those wages?
It's the so, I, you know, my earlier comment, if we are if we're advertising. If our hook around the country and around the world is come to Indiana, we're the lowest cost state, we're going to lose.
We're the cheapest.
And that's right.
come
and
here,
that's,
it's cheap.
And that's becoming obvious. Now, we can still tout our affordability as part of our overall value proposition, but I think the key, a number of big things need to happen, and I see them happening now. The problem is no one holds the answer. So, first of all, early childhood education, and we need to make much greater investments in early childhood education. And we, you know, I don't want to get people want to debate me. Indiana schools are good. Indiana schools are bad. The point is, we know what works nationwide, and we're finding out as part of our economic impact study what works, and that is figuring out a way to make these early investments in kids' lives. Does make a huge difference. It doesn't guarantee success. It makes a huge difference. The second thing, and I'm happy to hear, very happy to hear the governor talking a lot about this, is closing this middle skill gap that exists. Indiana, as a percentage of our population, had so many people working in manufacturing post-World War II. And that's part of the reason why those were great times, because we're ideal for manufacturing. We're centrally located. And when the federal highway system, federal interstate system came in, it really helped us. We're still very strong in manufacturing, but we have too many people who grew up with parents and grandparents for whom a high school diploma was enough to have a great career. Clearly, we've moved past that world, and so there's this disconnect right now where manufacturing is becoming more automated and more technical, and we're actually having a hard time filling those increasingly technical jobs with our own people here in Indiana. And so that means that and most of these jobs don't require a four-year degree. It's just some kind of – oftentimes it's a year or two. So that we've got to have a much greater focus. Manufacturing is not going away. Manufacturing will become a lot more automated, and it'll become a lot more high-tech. We know that. But manufacturing for us as a state is not going away. We need to do a better job of filling the pipeline of educated workers in these – you know, a career in technical education is most commonly the term – as automotive sector gets more automated, as aviation tech sector gets more automated, that we can fill those jobs with our own people.
And how important is the whole question of early childhood education then to this mix? I mean, that's the one that you keep coming back to. I've noticed in the conversation.
Yeah,
go ahead.
I think it's a competitive disadvantage for us. Okay, so full disclosure, my mother spent her entire career teaching kindergarten, pre-K, and Head Start. So my mother has been talking to me in this last year saying, "Congratulations, son, what took you so long?" And that was in Illinois.
We all have mothers.
Yeah, we do. Yeah, right. So that was in Illinois. Illinois had some, you know, pre-K, yeah. Not universal pre-K, but pre-K since the 1980s. Yeah. So and this becomes it becomes really important because we do have an unemployment problem, but we have an almost equally great work readiness problem. And you start to find this, like when I worked for the mayor, he'd come back and he'd say this a few times. He'd say, I just visited a manufacturing company. They said, I can't find good workers. In the same day, I visit a neighborhood and I meet dozens of people saying, I can't find a job. You know, the mayor shaking his head saying something's wrong. Right. So we've got to pay specific attention to that problem. Now, I think as the chamber, we do represent a lot of manufacturers in particular. We represent a lot of folks in logistics and distribution as well. There are specific professions where we know that companies are having to import their workers from other states and from around the world. So we know what those pipelines look like. It's just making sure that our businesses have better alignment with our educational institutions. And I'm glad that the governor and other people are bringing some special focus there.
We are talking with Michael Huber, who is the president and CEO of the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce. If you'd like to join the conversation, you can give us a buzz at 866-476-3881. Caller, welcome to the program. Caller?
Hello?
Yes. Yes, what's on your mind?
Hi. Well, I was just wanting to ask the speaker a little question about the right-to-work legislation and how that's supposed to contribute to an improved quality of life for a worker when we've seen since the Great Recession and all the economic recovery that's taken place, that and the right-to-work legislation it's interesting how when a company tries to do union busing, they get fined or sanctioned, and if an entire state does it, it's perfectly all right. But since all those jobs that went away during the Great Recession and the jobs that have taken that have been created since the Great Recession have been much lower on the income scale, I would like to know how that translates into a better standard of living for citizens.
Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Thank you.
I mean, well, your caller's going to be disappointed because our organization didn't take a stance on right mm-hmm. to work a few years ago.
Why was that? I mean, this is one of those things where obviously the state chamber didn't take a position on same-sex marriage, and the Indianapolis chamber did. Situation was reversed.
Yeah.
And right to work. I mean, that was priority number one for the state chamber.
Yeah.
And you guys pretty much sat that one out, right?
We did. And the simple answer is, I wasn't there. Simple mm-hmm. answer is, lots of members on both sides of the issue, right? Which didn't mm-hmm. happen for us on the HDR 6, HDR 3. We had a lot of members on one side of the issue. I think, and I don't want to assume too much about the caller, but I think I'll agree that, I mean, and I've said now a couple of times, if we're just advertising us as the low cost provider, we're going to lose out. Mm-hmm. There's no question. We've got to offer high quality, and that's got to be and a high value proposition to the rest of the world. And so, you know, for us, how do we attack the problem? So we're going to give also a greater focus to this expanding career and technical education and make sure that our members are really hands-on with academia and educational institutions so we're producing the right kinds of skills. I just don't know enough to answer the caller's question about the long-term impacts yet.
About how it would affect things.
That's right.
We are talking with Michael Huber, who is the president and CEO of the Indianapolis Chamber of Commerce. Caller, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Certainly.
I was calling first of all, I wanted to commend Mr. Huber and the Indianapolis Chamber on taking the position on gay marriage that they did. That might someday attract my three children back from the West Coast. But and also the flexibility on taxes. I was not wanting to ask specifically about environmental policy and what their position is and will be on global warming and Indiana's place in helping to reduce carbon emissions.
Thanks very much for the call and the question.
Michael. So, yeah, so I guess on first part, the Indianapolis Chamber as a city metro chamber, it'd be very rare that we'd get directly involved in a federal issue. We will work with other groups, mm-hmm. including U.S. Chamber, but not only limited to U.S. Chamber. So, now, that being said, we have taken positions on sustainability. We've had an organization called the Green Chamber of Commerce, which exists mm-hmm. within the Indy Chamber, which has been a great tool for us. We are supportive of the recent, and we're supportive of the city's recent moves to embrace the electric car share program, but it goes way beyond the electric car share program, also to going to an all alternative vehicle fleet mm-hmm. for the city of Indianapolis. We think that could be a great proving mm-hmm. ground for other large organizations and for the corporate sector to get on board. I think if I'm being self-serving and thinking just of our members here in Indiana, a lot of people don't realize that we've got a lot of the manufacturers here in Indiana that could supply alternative vehicles for generations to come. Allison Transmission is a successful, very successful company here in Indianapolis, and that powers, hybrid bus transmissions all over the world. We also have battery companies in Indianapolis who, would only stand to gain through the acceptance of hybrid vehicles for the smaller vehicles. And so we've been very supportive of, increasing sustainability. Now, the key for the Indy Chamber, though, is we will get behind initiatives around sustainability if we can also show our members that there's a positive long-term return on investment as well.
Is that the key? Because I know
key.
Part of it you said at the beginning that it, sort of the three prongs of the chamber's mission, and there is a lot of focus now on this question of sustainability, new green technologies,
right.
and all of that, that the businesses and the communities that get out in front of that are going to be the prosperous ones in the decades to come.
So I appreciate, I feel we have a great relationship with a group like Hoosier Environmental Council and Jesse Carbonda, their president, who's a personal friend of mine. where we find common ground with a group like Hoosier Environmental Council is where those sustainability initiatives where there's a clear benefit to our members, even if it's not a short-term benefit, and that puts us in a position to talk to our members about long-term benefits. One of our major issues we are taking on right now is regional water management.
Mm-hmm.
If we are in trouble in Indiana going out 20, 30, 40 years if we don't adopt stronger regional water management. And now people argue about is there a shortage coming in 25 years or is there a shortage coming in 35 years? The State Chamber actually did a great study on this released a couple of weeks ago. But there's no question, especially with our large commercial and large industrial companies, they're really eager to hear about how other chamber members cut their demand for water, 30-40%. And we've got chamber members who have done that. So that's part of the best practices, information sharing part of what we do that our members are very interested in. And one of those areas that we cover regularly is sustainability. As I said earlier, though, the common thread is how does it save money and how does it benefit our members so that the community benefits.
Or create opportunities for them to prosper in business.
Absolutely.
Create a climate like that. What in terms of that, what are the biggest challenges confronting the business community here?
Yeah. In Indiana, I grew up in Illinois. My wife grew up in the Bay Area. Mm-hmm. We love it here. Mm-hmm. This is our home now. For all the things we love, and this I think this will answer your question about what the biggest challenge is for the business. For all the things that we love about Indiana, there still too often is this undercurrent of, well, that's good enough, mm-hmm. And complacency, which is unfortunate because the things that the people that I work with in civic life, Indianapolis has accomplished incredible things as a city.
And if I could, yep. I could jump in. Is it a kind of cultural complacency or is it an economic? I mean, is it like,
I don't know.
We're not Cleveland, we're not Detroit, so we
yeah.
must be okay, kind of thing.
Yeah,
in economic terms, or it is. We're not that exciting. We're not Chicago, but that's okay too.
I think it's more the latter. And so,
okay.
Brian Payne from the Community Foundation, yeah. he'll say.
And again, he's been a guest on this.
Yeah,
show.
Yeah. So Brian's very, and he's on my board and my executive committee.
Yeah.
Brian's outspoken when he says he's from California, like yeah. my wife, and he'll say when people say, "Well, we don't have oceans, we don't have mountains," and he'll say that drives me crazy. Why do people lead with that? Right? When we've punched above our weight class in so many other areas, mm-hmm. and so I think. And luckily, and this is one thing I try to preach among our staff. Our members are smart. if they're men and women who've been successful in business, successful in their industries, they're smart, and they're also likely multifunctional, and they can take their business their skills learned in mm-hmm. engineering and apply it to other disciplines as well. But I do feel that sometimes we're fighting against kind of this. We've done it to ourselves. We have our own inferiority complex that we need to get over, and we need to be a lot more, cocky about the things that we have accomplished as a city, because we could point to so many things we've accomplished in the last 20 to 30 years that go far beyond what our peers in terms of population and other Midwestern cities have accomplished.
I think probably that's probably a pretty good last word. Yep. Would like to ask you, though, if you'd come back as we get a little close to the legislative
yep.
session, perhaps come back and talk about what the chamber's priorities would be going into that legislative session.
Absolutely. Be happy to.
I've enjoyed talking with you, Michael. Thank you for joining us. We will be back on Thursday. Hope you all will join us. I am John Kroll. You have been listening to No Limits. Thank you for joining us.
No Limits is a production of 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, Indianapolis. Producer, Shannon Cagle. Interactive Media Coordinator, Melissa Davis. Technical Producer, Cedric Freeman. And Board Engineer, Don Hibschweiler. We invite you to join us each week for No Limits, made available through IPBS, Indiana's public broadcasting stations.